shul Zoom room to give us his insights and appreciations of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Last week's presentation by Rav Ari was, I would say, very prescient and gave us some guidance into understanding the, and I know that many of our members did appreciate some of the events of the week through the lens that Ari shared with us last week. I should begin this evening by mentioning that the Rav that Ari grew up with, one of the giants of the American rabbinate, Rabbi Kellermer, left us on Erev Shabbos. And the Levaya was this morning. And anybody who lived in West Hempstead and far beyond, and every Rav who watched Rabbi Kellermer very closely, certainly feels a great sense of loss. And I'm sure that our own Rabbi Lam is suffering with the same loss as a young man growing up in the close precincts of and the guidance and the wisdom of Rabbi Kellermer. This evening we turn our focus to Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, as one of the great communicators of the Mesorah. And just as of last week, I presented Rabbi Lam as a Fulbright scholar, as a having a doctorate from Princeton, and being an accomplished Talmud Chacham and an engaging presenter. But in the meantime, since last week, Rabbi Lam published a remarkable essay in Newsweek. It's amazing how one presentation of the Beth Abraham catapults somebody to the front lines of the Newsweek. We can only imagine what's going to happen next week after your second presentation to our shul. But I'm sure everyone will want to have a look at the essay that Rabbi Lam wrote and the insight that he has and the optimism he speaks. And I look forward. Rabbi Lam, please, it's all yours.
Many thanks to Armara D'Asra for the very kind words of introduction. I actually had planned to begin, and actually I'll share my screen if I can. I had planned to begin my remarks with a quick story about Rabbi Kellermer, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, given his untimely passing this week. We did not have as long with him as we should have and as we would have loved to. I'll tell a quick story about Rabbi Kellermer simply because first and foremost, because sometimes the soul wants what it wants, but also because I hope it will bear upon the character that we're going to, the spiritual giant that we're going to examine this evening. I remember growing up, I have a wonderful friend and a chavruso now lives in Israel by the name of David Eckstein. And we always used to, he grew up in West Hempstead as I did. And we used to joke that growing up, you know, you would go to cousins or friends' houses for Shabbos. And then you would go to shuls where in which you'd never been before and that you hadn't attended before. And you'd meet rabbis and rabbinic personalities that you hadn't ever before encountered. And anyone who grew up in West Hempstead with Rabbi Kellermer, and was aware of his presence in our lives beyond the merely rabbinic, but really felt his influence and the impact of his love for all of us, we would all have the same experience, which was you would go to a shul and you would encounter a rabbi And inevitably, you would wonder how this person ever got their position because they didn't know Shas by heart. What kind of rabbi doesn't know Shas by heart? I mean, we all grew up with a rabbi who not only knew Shas by heart, but I fondly remember learning when I was young, I fondly remember learning a Kehilas Yaakov from the Stipler with my father's close friend. It was the most advanced learning I'd done to date. I was sort of like, you know, a young high school student at the time. And we were learning about the difference between Misasek and Davar Sheni Miskaven and the Kehilas Yaakov as this very complicated and complex essay on the topic. We couldn't make heads or tails. Certainly I couldn't, but even the person with whom I was studying, who was a prodigious Talmud Chacham in his own right, couldn't make heads or tails of it. So we decided to ask Rabbi Kelemer. And Rabbi Kelemer said, oh, you mean this one? And he started quoting it Baal Peh with no background. He wasn't learning Shabbos at the time. He just knew it by heart. And we all, you know, my chavrusa and I would reminisce about how it always seems so strange to go to, you know, your average young Israel and the rabbi would be perfectly wonderful and lovely, but they, you know, how did they ever get to their position? It was not until we got older that we realized how unusual and extraordinary Rabbi Kelemer was. And so with that as background, I'll just relate one remarkable drasha that I remember he gave. I think the mood took him and he got up in front of the shul and he said, Rabbi Kelemer was the Talmud of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. I learned with him for many years. And he said, anybody who learned with Rav Chaim Shmulevitz and tells you that they never listened to Bob Dylan is a liar. And he then proceeded to darshan the lyrics of Like a Rolling Stone. And I will never forget it precisely because of how strange that the experience was of hearing a Rav engage that sort of source material for a drasha. And but the truth is, I think for that reason, I have always been attracted to unusual rabbinic personalities, personalities who are learned, who are deeply traditional, who are rooted firmly and proudly, unabashedly in the Masorah, but who do something a little bit different with their lives. And for that reason, I was always drawn in particular to Rabbi Sacks. And I was fortunate over the course of many years, once I had become an adult, to merit a wonderful relationship with him. I was in his house many times. My wife and I actually lived in London for a bit. That was where my oldest daughter was born, which is why we always say she's very polite and has bad teeth, so you know where she's from. So we were fortunate to spend some time with Rabbi Sacks, but certainly as I got older and my relationship with him became not one of geographical happenstance, but one of deep intellectual and spiritual and religious admiration, I was fortunate enough to strike up a relationship with him that lasted for many years and unfortunately was cut short, as was his relationship with all of us. I think it is probably impossible to do justice to the oeuvre of a rabbinic personality of such a prolific pen. I mean, typically, you know, it's impossible to reduce the Torah of any Talmud Chacham to an hour long presentation. But the difficulty here is not merely religious, or it's not merely related to the irreducibility of Torah. It's just from a practical perspective. Or Sacks wrote so much that it's very difficult to distill it into something that you can cover in, you know, a half an hour. But I'd like to try nevertheless. And I think the truth is, at the risk of greatly oversimplifying, I do think that it is true that there was one problem above all others that occupied Rabbi Sacks's, that engaged Rabbi Sacks's imagination and occupied his intellectual output. And I think by appreciating that one question, that one problem, quite nearly all of Rabbi Sacks's Torah is unlocked, or rather the reason why he wrote everything that he wrote is unlocked. Now, Rabbi Sacks innovated any number of wonderful chidushim and wrote on an endless variety of topics. And so I don't mean to oversimplify Rabbi Sacks's output, but I do think there was much like any great thinker, there was one great problem, a problem of epic historical proportions that Rabbi Sacks was trying to solve. And he dedicated, and like all great problems, this one required a career to address. And Rabbi Sacks, I think, addressed that question. I'd like to introduce this question by way of an unusual source. And that is by an essay that was written in appreciation of Rabbi Sacks by a man named Sora Bamari. Sora Bamari is the op-ed editor, the current op-ed editor of the New York Post. He is a fascinating figure in his own right. He hails from Iran. His father was a member of the administration of the Ayatollah. Eventually, he and his family managed to escape the clutches of the regime, which preyed even upon its adherents. They moved to America. He became disenchanted with Shia Islam, and became a Farbrente atheist. It was only and a drunk. It was only when he had a terrible bender that over the course of which he smashed in with his car into a police vehicle. It was only when he had a terrible bender in the vicinity of Penn Station and managed somehow to survive it that he stumbled upon a Capuchin monastery, which is nestled in the storefronts right near Penn Station, for those of you who know the area, that he had a stark conversion experience and became a very firm Roman Catholic. And he's now one of the most prestigious and prolific Catholic thinkers. He is also, in addition to all of that, an extraordinary Ohev Yisrael, an extraordinary Ohev Yisrael. And in the wake of Rabbi Sacks' passing, he wrote an appreciation of Rabbi Sacks that I think is perhaps the most profound of all of the appreciations that I encountered. And I'd like to read to you just the beginning of it. He published it in the journal First Things, the Journal of Religion. And he wrote the following. He said, "The West, according to an account beloved by Catholics, rose out of a providential encounter between reason and revelation in antiquity. Though occasioned by conquest, the encounter yielded an authentic synthesis between a Greek rationality in search of the deepest origin of reality and a Jewish God, professed to be just that, the very ground of being. Later, that same God identified himself even more starkly and intimately with reason." And here he's referring to the New Testament. "Tragically," the story goes on, "this synthesis eventually lost its supremacy in the West, owing foremost to opponents inside the church determined to distill a purer faith unmodeled by worldly philosophy." He's referring now to the Protestant Reformation. "And the result was a stingy account of reason that excluded things divine and paved the way for a narrowly scientistic rationality. Today, we are the victims of this disintegration, a process of Christian de-Hellenization centuries in the making." So what he's saying essentially, and here he's absolutely correct, the history of the West, of the Christian West, the pre-American West, as it were, or the pre-Protestant West, can be told as, in terms of Roman Catholicism, as the story of a God who is ultimately the God of nature and the God of rationality, finally being discovered by people who now had the tools to properly appreciate him. So before the coming of the Christian Bible, you had a God who was the God of nature, but the Jewish people didn't have the ability to properly appreciate him. And it was only once the Jewish people had been unjustly conquered by the Hellenistic world, by the world of Greek wisdom, had been unjustly conquered by them, that providentially the reason of the Greek philosophical tradition was brought into contact, fateful contact, with the God who was the God of reason. And finally, that synthesis between reason and revelation was allowed to take place. And that synthesis between reason and revelation was Christianity. And as Sohrab Amari noted in this, and remember, Sohrab is a Catholic, and so he believes this story, but he appreciated very, very deeply, and he was a deep admirer of Rabbi Sacks, and this essay was dedicated to this topic. As he says in the last sentence here, "The late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who died last month, utterly rejected this account of faith and reason." Rabbi Sacks was deeply opposed to this. And I contend that in order to appreciate quite literally everything that Rabbi Sacks wrote and spoke about, you need to understand that Rabbi Sacks was responding to this very account. What is the relationship between the God of the Bible, the God of Israel, between Hashem, and reason and scientific rationality? Christendom, which was what we called the West before we became secularized, Christendom had asserted that reason and revelation were inextricably bound together, which meant, of course, not only that science was pursued by religious men, but even more importantly, that metaphysics, that the study of God, the theology, as it were, was pursued with the systematic habits of a scientific mind. In other words, the great theologians of Catholic antiquity believed that you could actually study God and religious things the way you would study biology. And Rabbi Sacks rejected this thesis and argued that instead, the God of Israel, that Hashem, represented something other than scientific reason. The question is, what, or had some relationship, some different relationship to scientific reason. The question is, what was that? What kind of God is the God of Israel? This was the question that animated every single thing that Rabbi Sacks wrote. And Rabbi Sacks' answer was this. And this is from Rabbi Sacks' introduction to the volume on Bereshis from Covenant and Conversation. Rabbi Sacks said, the Torah is not myth. And here I'm reading from over here. The Torah is not myth. It is not history in the conventional sense, a mere recording of events, nor is it theology. Genesis is less about God than about human beings and their relationship to God. The theology is almost always implicit rather than explicit. And anyone who has ever learned the Blat Gemara will know that the philosophy of Halacha has always been implicit, has across Jewish history always been implicit rather than explicit. What Genesis is, in fact, is philosophy written in a deliberately non-philosophical way. It deals with all the central questions of philosophy: what exists, ontology, what can we know, epistemology, are we free, philosophical psychology, and how we should behave, ethics, but it does so in a way quite unlike the philosophical classics from Plato to Wittgenstein. To put it at its simplest, philosophy is truth as a system. Genesis is truth as a story. And that sentence, Genesis is truth as a story, is a key to understanding every single thing Rabbi Sacks wrote. According to Rabbi Sacks, the God of Israel was not a God that you can investigate via reason, and that Hashem is not ultimately impressive because impressive only because he is the author of creation and the author of the laws of nature. What makes God critically important to us is the fact that God has, in the Jewish tradition, has a relationship with us. The fact that we have experienced things with God. The fact that we have stories with God. And ultimately, the God that Rabbi Sacks believed in and that he believed was the true essence, or rather the true essence of Hashem that we human beings can perceive, is that God is the God of stories. So we may owe God fealty for abstract reasons, right? Because he's the creator and he owns us. So we have to obey God for all sorts of reasons that the Rambam enumerates at the beginning of Sefer Mada. But that relationship that we have with God only becomes real, and it can only develop through stories. Because relationships are composed of stories, of experiencing together both love and loss, despair and hope. And that was the God of Rabbi Sacks. And that meant, and what I now, again, at the risk of trying to, we'll never be able to cover all of Rabbi Sacks' writings, but what I want to illustrate to you is the way in which this very simple understanding of, or rather this very simple commitment that Rabbi Sacks made to understanding Hashem helped Rabbi Sacks answer some of the most important questions that he ever addressed. And anyone who has any familiarity with Rabbi Sacks knows that he was deeply interested only in those most important and critical questions. So the first, the three essential questions that I argue this helped Rabbi Sacks answer, although this list is not exhaustive. The first one is, what is the relationship between religion and science? God or Hashem, as our relationship with Hashem as being characterized by stories, helped Rabbi Sacks answer that question. What is the relationship between Jews and other nations? It also helped Rabbi Sacks answer that question. And finally, what is the relationship between religion and morality? How do you explain how moral change occurs? How does humanity get better? In order to answer that question, Rabbi Sacks used this principle, as God is the God of stories. Okay, so let's start at the first one. What is the relationship between religion and science? And this was really the subject of Rabbi Sacks's book called The Great Partnership, Science, Religion, and the Search for Meaning, which was actually written in response to the book The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, who's perhaps the best known of what are typically referred to as the New Atheists. He's a particularly obnoxious manifestation of the New Atheists. But Rabbi Sacks took him very seriously as a scientific writer, and actually engaged, and this was one of the things that made Rabbi Sacks's public career, he engaged in a public debate with Richard Dawkins. And we'll come back to that debate in a moment, because it's important to understand why Rabbi Sacks engaged with him and how Rabbi Sacks argued with Dawkins. But in The Great Partnership, Rabbi Sacks sought to address that age-old question of how can we reconcile science and religion? Need they be reconciled? How do we deal with the contradictions, apparent contradictions between science and religion? And Rabbi Sacks ultimately answered the question as follows. Rabbi Sacks said that God, the God of Israel, is actually not the God of how. That when people typically address the question of what's the relationship between science and religion, they're usually asking, Rabbi Sacks thought, the wrong question. They're asking the question of how. And the question of how, that was the question that united pre-modern myth and pagans and modern science. Because if you think about the way that polytheists used their gods, which is what they did, because of course, as the Torah points out, in paganism, gods are there to serve man rather than man to serve God. The way that pagans used their gods was to explain how things happened. So if there was a drought, it was because the god of thunder was displeased. If your ship sank, it was because Poseidon was angry that day. If you were unlucky in business, it was because Hermes or Mercury in the Latin tradition was frowning upon you. And similarly, when modern science seeks to explain things, it's always also addressing that question of how. So in other words, if a modern scientist asks, why do human beings have this or that trait, the answer you will get will come from evolutionary biology, which explains, well, it was for this reason that human beings evolved a particular trait. And what Rabbi Sacks pointed out is that that's actually not answering the question of why, that's answering the question of how humanity developed such a trait. This was the way that they did it. And Rabbi Sacks pointed this out in his book. He said, the gods of polytheism and all their buzzing, boisterous confusion were within the universe. They were subject to nature. They did not create it. They may have been stronger than human beings. They were certainly longer lived. They were immortal, but they were within the universe. And therefore, in principle, they could not give meaning to the universe. The same is true for science, whose subject is the interrelationship of things within the natural world. There's a great deal of difference between giving a climatological explanation of rain and explaining that rain is the work of the Aztec god Tlaloc, and so on through an impressive cast list of gods and goddesses of inundation. Science is not myth. Myth is not science, but they are both explanations of some phenomenon within nature in terms of other phenomena within nature. And in this sense, myth is proto-science. Science displaces myth. And Rabbi Sacks argued that religion, and specifically monotheistic religion, is the only source in the world that actually allows us to answer a different and in many ways more important question, which is why? what is the meaning of all of existence? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of the human physiology? What is the meaning of human interaction? Now, the question is, how does the monotheistic God allow us to answer this in a way that science and the polytheistic gods do not? Well, here, Rabbi Sacks was very fond, if you ever heard him speak about this, was very fond of telling a story. And Rabbi Sacks would often say, well, imagine that you are a person, imagine that you're an alien from outer space, and you arrive on this planet, and the first place that you to which you are taken by escorted by government agents is to a soccer match. And you go there and you see one team playing against another team, and you see the people and you see the spectators deeply invested in the outcome. And in fact, they're yelling at each other and screaming at each other. And one side appears to hate the people wearing these clothes, and the other side appears to hate the people wearing the other color clothing. And imagine that, the alien were to ask, why are people so excited about this? And the person who was giving the answer simply explained the rules of soccer. Would that answer the alien's question? The answer, of course, is no. If the alien wanted to know how it is or why it is that each player, that one player is trying to score a goal on this side by kicking it through a net on this side, and the other one is trying to score a goal by kicking a net on the other side, then the rules would help, because that ultimately is a question of how. How does soccer work? But if you want to know why is a person so invested in, as Jerry Seinfeld put it, laundry, ultimately, why is a fan so invested in the performance of their team, you would have to step far outside the system of soccer, as it were, and you'd have to talk about things much greater than the rules of soccer, like the history of competition, you'd have to talk about honor and shame. You'd have to talk about love and loss. You'd have to talk about local patriotism. You'd have to talk about things far outside the realm of the system of the rules of soccer itself. And so too, when it comes to finding meaning in the world, the only way to find meaning, or the only way to answer the question of why do we exist and why is the world the way it is to step outside the system of creation. And the only being that has ever been introduced to humanity that actually exists outside the system and therefore can provide us with a sense of meaning, with an answer to our why questions, is the monotheistic God, is the God of Israel. And you will note, therefore, that the only way that God outside the system can help us understand meaning. So in other words, God being outside the system can see the meaning of everything. But how is that meaning communicated to us? Well, as Rabbi Sacks answered over the course of this entire book, the way that God, the monotheistic God, communicates to humanity the meaning of everything that goes on in their lives is through retelling to them the stories of everything that they've experienced, but by injecting it with meaning. So for example, as Rabbi Sacks was also often fond of saying, it is actually possible, and he cites a scientific study that had confirmed this, that it is possible if you look at the Red Sea, that if the wind is blowing from the east at 68 miles an hour, and it is a particular time of tide, and the tide is at a particular level, it is actually possible to identify a way for there to be a dry path through the Red Sea from Egypt to the other side. It's possible. The fact that this occurred, that this unbelievably unlikely one in a million, one in a quintillion happenstance, occurrence, happened at precisely the moment when the most powerful empire in the world was pursuing the weakest people in the world. And when the weakest people in the world were able to traverse the Red Sea because they had nothing but themselves to carry across. And it was the most powerful that were undone by the very instruments of their power, their chariots, who were bogged down in the Red Sea. The very fact that nature, that science, interacted with human morality at that precise moment in time. What are we to make of that? That's what the Chumash is for. It's the stories of the Chumash. It is God telling us the stories of what happens in his world, but giving us meaning, giving us a way to understand it. That was what Rabbi Sacks believed was the way to explain the relationship between science and religion. It is, as Rabbi Sacks often said, science aims to take things apart and ask, how do they work? Religion puts things back together and asks, what do they mean? That was how Rabbi Sacks understood or thought that Judaism uniquely explained the relationship between science and religion. Now, on to the next question. What is the relationship between Jews and other nations? And here too, Rabbi Sacks believed that stories, and in particular the stories that God tells us or that God's prophets tell us, helped explain the relationship between Jews and other nations. And here, Rabbi Sacks, this was the problem that Rabbi Sacks engaged in his book, The Dignity of Difference. And this is, in fact, one of the most audacious arguments that Rabbi Sacks ever made. Rabbi Sacks began The Dignity of Difference by addressing what he called Plato's ghost. And let me unpack what that means for a moment. Many people are familiar with the classic tension between tribalism on the one hand and universalism on the other hand, right? So you can think of human affairs as organized along two poles, right? There are people who stick together with their tribes and only like members of the in-group and view everybody else as an enemy. And then there's universalism, which sees sort of everybody as having, ultimately being on the same team and adhering to the same values. And sort of the traditional morality of the West, especially that Catholic doctrine that we explored at the beginning, that sees reason and revelation as united, quite naturally described the march of religious history as being a march from tribalism to universalism, right? Humanity started out as a bunch of warring nations, and ultimately, the next big step on the way to universalism was identifying a monotheistic God. That was what the Jews did, thank you. And then, once the Jews took that as far as they could, it was left to Christianity to take the next step and say that really, this one God is actually the God of all humanity, and there is only one way towards salvation. And once Christianity began to lose its steam, and the Enlightenment began to suck away much of the moral and spiritual energy that Christianity had typically supplied for the West, it was the Enlightenment that sort of took the logical next step of Christianity and said that really, there is only one truth, there is only science, and all human beings everywhere are subject to that truth, and there are no particular things that bind us together, there are no particular beliefs that bind us together, and everybody should sort of, in essence, be subject to one and only one universal morality. And Rabbi Sacks, of course, was one of the, on the one hand, one of the great critics of tribalism. And Rabbi Sacks correctly and maybe obviously identified the dangers of tribalism and its modern incarnation of nationalism or unconsecrated nationalism, a nationalism that has no purpose other than to celebrate the nation itself. So you might think of it in Lumdish terms as nationalism lishma. Rabbi Sacks, of course, pointed out that that tribalism is dangerous because it runs the risk of encouraging people to act violently towards other people, to act with suspicion and hatred towards other people. However, Rabbi Sacks was also one of the great contemporary critics of universalism. And Rabbi Sacks saw universalism as, first of all, dehumanizing. Because what universalism does, what universalism does is that it sees all individuals, or really all things, as just examples of a larger type. So, and this is what Rabbi Sacks actually referred to as Plato's ghost, because Plato, one of the classical doctrines for which Plato is known, is that Plato believed that nothing in this world is actually real or objectively real. Everything in this world is just an example of an ideal form that can be found in the heavens. So if you've ever heard anybody refer to Plato's cave, that's what they're referring to. Plato sort of had this allegory in mind. The way that he used to explain this was that imagine if you're living in a cave and somebody outside the cave is projecting the shadow of a cow onto the wall in the cave. And all you can see, you can't see the cow. All you can see is the shadow of a cow. So you can't know what a cow really is, but you can know sort of what a shadow of a cow looks like. And by pursuing that shadow, you can find your way back to truth. Plato said that's what Olam Hazeh is. Olam Hazeh is being in the cave. It's only once we're able to get to the Olam HaEmes that we can actually know what truth really is. And Rabbi Sacks thought that this was, first of all, a dehumanizing way to think about people, because it assumes that no individual human being is actually intrinsically worthwhile. You're just an example of a larger type. So there's no such thing, as Rabbi Sacks put it, in Platonic thought, there's no such thing as men, there's only man, capital M. There's no such thing as truths, there's only truth, capital T. And Rabbi Sacks thought that was dangerous, not only because it's dehumanizing, but also, and in addition, because it convinces people that there is one and only one way to truth, and that way lies madness and chaos and war. The Bible, however, he noted, actually tells the opposite story. The Bible does not go from tribalism to universalism. In fact, it is the only moral tradition that goes in the opposite direction. Because the Bible, remember, begins with God making a deal, as it were, or creating a relationship with all of humanity, with Adam and Chava, with the ancestors of all of humanity. And that, of course, fails. So God tries again. And God tries to create a relationship with the first two human siblings, Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel. Of course, Cain kills Hevel. And murder is introduced into the world. And so that fails. God tries again and attempts to rebuild a new world through Noah, through Shem, Ham, and Yavaz, and the thing fails again. And so finally, God decides to create a relationship with a particular family, one family, a relationship rooted in love and affection and mutual care. And by giving that family a particular responsibility, God was able to model for all of humanity a critical point, which Rabbi Sacks described in the book as follows. So Rabbi Sacks argued that the faith of Israel, and here I'm going to start down here, the faith of Israel declares, the oneness of God and the plurality of man, which is to say that. If there's anything that we learn from the Torah, it's that God is one and only God is one. So the famous example that Rabbi Sacks always liked to bring was Migdal Bavel, that God is opposed to global human government. God likes for there to be different societies because it is only in recognizing the diversity and the plurality of God's creation that we can truly appreciate both God's oneness and the beauty and the bounty of the Bria. And so, as Rabbi Sacks argued, it moves beyond, that the faith of Israel moves beyond both tribalism and its antithesis universalism. Tribalism and its modern counterpart nationalism assumes there is one God or spirit or race or character for each nation. Universalism contends that there is one God and therefore only one truth, one way, one creed for all humanity. Neither does justice to the human other, the stranger who is not in my image, but is nevertheless in God's image. And here he's referring to a statement in Chazal, which is that when humans make coins, so they use only one image and it creates, I believe he quotes it up here, at the top here, as an ancient Jewish teaching puts it, when a human being makes many coins in the same mint, they all come out the same. God makes every person in the same image, his image, and each one is different. That God is the only being that could create, millions, billions, trillions of people in the same image, in the same divine image, and yet every single one is different. And as Rabbi Sacks says up here, the challenge to the religious imagination is to see God's image in one who is not in our image. So the challenge that Judaism, from Rabbi Sacks' perspective, uniquely solved was that we were able to recognize that on the one hand, every single human being shares something in common, and that's the divine image. And yet, every single human being is different, and cultures and societies are different. And it is only in recognizing that difference that we can truly appreciate the beauty of the world that God has created. As he says, But it is something other than universalism. Judaism takes difference seriously. And here is where Rabbi Sacks was at his most audacious. If you look at this last paragraph, he says, "We do not have to share a creed or code to be partners in the covenant of mankind. The prophets of Israel wrestle with an idea still counterintuitive to the Platonic mind, that moral and spiritual dignity extend far beyond the boundaries of any one civilization. They belong to the other, the outsider, the stranger, the one who does not fit our system, race, or creed." I want to pause for a moment just so that the radical nature of that idea can sink in. Rabbi Sacks believed, and he believed Judaism believed as a whole, Rabbi Sacks believed that Judaism was unique among world religious traditions in introducing the following claim. There is no universal, there is not only universal truth. There are some universal truths, universal human dignity, religious liberty. He believed that those were universal truths. However, Judaism was unique among world religions in affirming that there are multiple paths to God. How do I know this? Well, as Rabbi Sacks put it, it's quite easy to see if you read the Torah. So, you know, we like to say that the Torah is sort of the blueprint for the world, and of course that's true. But let me just present to you a thought experiment. You know, we're very familiar with the Midrash that God presented the Torah to many different nations, and they all rejected it, and it was only Am Yisrael who accepted it, and therefore we have it. Now, let me ask you a question: is it possible that God presented the Torah that we have in its current form to every single other nation, and they rejected it? Is it possible? It seems to me that it is impossible that that happened. We're meant to learn something else from this Midrash, but could it have been possible? Imagine this: imagine that God had taken the Torah and had presented it to the Sanskrit peoples of India in its current form. Well, what's the first question they would have asked? They wouldn't have asked, well, can we still murder? Can we still steal? Can we still do? The first thing they would have asked is, what is an Edomite? What is a Midianite? I mean, the Torah is full of all sorts of stories of actual events that happened to the Jewish people. The Torah is not a philosophical system. It is a record of God's unique and special relationship with the Jewish people. And our responsibility is to abide by the terms of that relationship so that we can serve as a model for every other nation to create their own relationship with God based on their own stories. Now, of course, as Rabbi Sacks affirmed many, many times in this book and elsewhere, there are certain minimum requirements of civilization that we believe are binding upon all people, that there is a universal element to Judaism. We call those, we have formalized those things in halachic terminology as the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. But it is true that no other people suffered slavery in Egypt. Only we did. No other people was brothers with Esau. Only we were. No other people had a relationship with Yishmael that we did. Only we did. And so, if it is to be true, as R.S. Sacks believed it was, if there is going to be something that avoids the dangers of tribalism and the dangers of universalism, if there is going to be a philosophy that does that, it will only be a philosophy that argues and that asserts that it is possible to have a relationship with God in many different ways, as long as it's rooted in certain universal elements, but it's possible to have a relationship with God in many different ways. That philosophy, the only philosophy that can sustain that in the history of human civilization, he believed was Judaism, was the Hebrew Bible. And as you can see, it is only because Rabbi Sacks believed, or it was only because, as Rabbi Sacks pointed out, that the Torah is grounded in stories, in the particulars of one people's relationship with God, that morality was made possible. Rabbi Sacks believed that, and that's why this book is called "The Dignity of Difference." Was meant as a way to explain how society should navigate in the wake of 9/11. That's really what the dignity of difference was about. It was sort of a response to the global war on terror. Rabbi Sacks believed that it was only Judaism that would allow us to make it through this period, because it was only Judaism and the traditions of the Bible that allow us to, on the one hand, to assert certain universal principles, and at the same time, have different types of relationships with God, to respect the dignity of difference. Okay. And finally, Rabbi Sacks believed that the idea of God as the God of stories can answer another critical question, and that is, what is the relationship between religion and morality? And what I mean by this is, you need to have some account, if you are a serious moral thinker or a serious religious thinker, you need to have some way to account for the fact that moral change happens, right? So in other words, one of the classic canards or one of the classic, I think, false challenges lobbed at religion is, well, you know, religious people supported slavery. How can we take religion seriously if they supported all sorts of horrible things in the past, right? Haven't we evolved beyond religion? So any serious religious thinker needs to be able to respond to that kind of challenge. And Rabbi Sacks was no different. Rabbi Sacks therefore came up with quite a robust theory of how religious change, of how moral change occurs and how religion supports moral change, while at the same time preserving the dignity and the absolute and eternal nature of the Masorah. Rabbi Sacks, I'll refer you to a moment in Rabbi Sacks's Covenants and Conversation, the volume on Vayikra, which of all the covenants, if you're going to buy one Covenants and Conversation volume, and I would recommend Vayikra. The one in Vayikra is, all the Covenants and Conversation volumes are very good, but the one on Vayikra is truly extraordinary. It's worth buying. Rabbi Sacks in Covenants and Conversation and Vayikra, actually in Parshas Bahar, asked the following question. He said, how do we explain the success of the glorious revolution in England in the 17th century, which led to England's parliamentary system? How do we explain the success or the lasting success of the American Revolution on the one hand? And how do we explain the terrible failures and death and horror caused by the French Revolution, which sent 40,000 people to the guillotine over the course of a couple of months, essentially, and the Communist Revolution, which resulted in the worst totalitarian regime in world history? And Rabbi Sacks argued that it is not a coincidence that the former two revolutions, the Glorious Revolution and the American Revolution, were rooted in the theology and the thinking and the values and ideas of the Torah, of the Hebrew Bible, as interpreted by the children of the Reformation, including eventually the Puritans. While the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution were born ultimately of either the Greek philosophical tradition, like Rousseau and the French Revolution, or in reaction or as a rejection of the Greek philosophical tradition, so Hegel and Marx. And the philosophers, as Rabbi Sacks pointed out, the problem with the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution is that philosophers actually don't have a theory of change. The philosophers just ask, is something right? Can we prove that something is right? If it is, then let's do it. Is something wrong? Can we prove that it's wrong? Then let's destroy it. And philosophers or philosophy as a system, whether it's Rousseau or whether it was Karl Marx, don't have a way to account for things or don't have moral patience for things changing gradually. And so if you don't have patience for things changing gradually, then you're going to run into an itty bitty problem, which is a small thing called human nature. Since the French and the Russians did not have patience for things like human nature, the only way that they could get around things like human nature in the interests of pushing forward their ambitious social programs was to radically reinvent or assert that they were reinventing human nature. So Rousseau believed that humanity, the problem with humanity was essentially community. All of the institutions of society, especially religion, that we had invented have sort of fooled us into feeling responsible to other people. The best way that we can be finally happy and virtuous is to return to the state of nature and tear down all of those institutions that we had erected in our society. So religion, gotta go. Family, gotta go. All those things are bad for us. And it was that produced the horrors of the French Revolution. Because if you have no theory for how to harness human nature when you're conducting change, the result is bloodshed. Same thing with the Communist Revolution. Roy Sachs, however, thought that the Bible had a very that the Bible was quite different than philosophy, and that the Bible and that the Torah has a very robust theory of how things change. And so Rabbi Sachs's great example of this was slavery. So just consider that, I mean, these are Parshas HaShavua. Consider Zinyana Dioma. So consider the Torah's attitude towards slavery. On the one hand, the entire thrust of Sefer Shmos is that slavery is an offense to God and that human bondage is an abomination. And yet, and God enunciates this principle on many, many occasions that it is unacceptable for the Jewish people to be enslaved, that Paro is so evil for keeping the Jewish people in bondage that he literally has his Bechira Chavshis taken away. And yet, as Rabbi Sachs pointed out, the Bible does not abolish slavery. The Bible does not abolish slavery right away. However, and why? Because as Rabbi Sachs pointed out, if the Bible had abolished slavery immediately on the sole grounds that it was wrong, it would have failed. What the Bible does is it arranges, however, for the ultimate demise of slavery by introducing a subtle but fatal flaw into the system of slavery. And that was by insisting that slavery is not what Rabbi Sachs called an ontological condition, but rather a temporary circumstance. So Aristotle, for example, believed, and Rabbi Sachs quotes Aristotle infamously believed that some people are born to be slaves and some people are born to be masters, much as there is a difference between man and beast, there is a difference, an essential difference between man and beast, there is an essential difference between master and slave. Some people are born to be slaves. The Torah, without abolishing slavery, simply undid that position of Aristotle's, or preempted that position of Aristotle's. Because if you believe that slavery is part of who you are, then slavery will persist forever. And it's no accident that every abolitionist throughout history, all of the great abolitionists from England to the United States and beyond, all rooted themselves not in the Greek philosophical traditions, but in the wisdom and morality of the Bible. The reason is because what the Bible did, without abolishing slavery directly, the Bible said, you can be a slave, but you are to be set free at certain intervals, either every 6 years or at a maximum every 50 years. Why? Ki avadayim, because the Jewish people ultimately are my servants and not servants to any human being. And by asserting that slavery was merely something that happened to you rather than who you are, the Torah puts slavery on the ultimate road to abolition. And so Rabbi Sachs argued that it is true that man must undergo radical moral changes. That's the only way. I mean, if man doesn't morally develop, then there's no point to this, to our entire existence. But the greatest changes, Rabbi Sachs believed, happen organically, and that takes time. And here too, Rabbi Sachs, in arguing this point, Rabbi Sachs relied on Hashem as the God of stories. So as Rabbi Sachs writes at the very end of this essay, he says, why did the great philosophical moral revolutions fail, even though they were laudable in their aims? Why did the great philosophical revolutions fail, but the great religious revolutions always succeeded? The answer is because philosophy is often detached from history in a concrete sense of humanity. Philosophy sees truth as system. The Torah tells truth as story. And a story is a sequence of events extended through time. Revolutions based on philosophical systems fail because change in human affairs takes time, and philosophy has rarely given an adequate account of the human dimension of time. But revolutions based on the Tanakh succeed because they go with the grain of human nature, recognizing that it takes time for people to change. The Torah didn't abolish slavery, but it set in motion a process that would lead people to come of their own accord to the conclusion that it was wrong. That it did so, albeit slowly, is one of the wonders of history. And as Rabbi Sachs points out in this essay, the way that the Torah institutes moral change is the logic of stories. Just like it would be absurd at the beginning, just to take one random example, just like it would be absurd for the very first scene of The Godfather, for sort of a narrator to come on and say, the following film is going to teach you about the dangers of surrendering the human soul to depravity, and then have to watch the whole movie knowing exactly what it's about, just like it would be absurd and The Godfather would be a poorer movie for that. Similarly, and in fact, the way that stories work is you have to be led down the path. You have to be led there in order to feel the emotional weight. There's a reason why Rabbi Sacks believes, accordingly, all of the great truths in history are expressed not through prose, but through poetry. Not through philosophy, but through story. And the same was true of the Torah. And with this in mind, I'd actually like, in the minute remaining to us, to demonstrate to you that my theory, or at least to attempt to demonstrate to you that my theory of Rabbi Sacks is correct. And as I promised you, we're going to come back to the debate between Richard Dawkins and Rabbi Sacks. And I want to call your attention to a quick moment in this debate that I think, where Rabbi Sacks sort of makes a joke as an aside, and but we actually can decipher what Rabbi Sacks meant, because he doesn't take the time to respond to Dawkins on this. And I'd like to play just a quick second. The subject here, just so you have the background, is that Richard Dawkins argued that the Akedah was a moral travesty, because if God wanted to abolish child sacrifice by showing that human beings don't own their children, God owns their children, right? Which is what Rabbi Sacks had argued. Why didn't God just say no more human sacrifice and that's it? So here's what Rabbi Sacks says.
Why? If God wanted to tell Abraham and tell the Jews not to sacrifice children, why didn't he just tell them? I mean, why put Abraham and Isaac through that horrific ordeal?
I'll tell you why, Richard. Because every self-respecting God in those days, Ra, Kamosh, Baal, and all the rest of them, said, sacrifice your child. So God said to Abraham, Abraham, don't sacrifice your child. Abraham might have found that pretty hard to take. But taking him all the way up there and then slamming on the brakes left an impression on Jews, not just on Abraham, to this day, that we have become a child-focused religion. I don't know any religion.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, but the original story seems to be the most appalling child 100%. Abuse. Child abuse.
I agree with you, Richard, and you are reading it. Forgive me for saying this, the Christian way.
Well,
and so, in the time remaining, I would simply ask you to unpack that, because Rabbi Sacks is sort of toying with Dawkins here, and I think if you watch the debate, you'll see that it's not even a close contest. Rabbi Sacks sort of, I don't use this lightly, kind of wipes the floor with Dawkins, but I think we actually can understand here exactly what Rabbi Sacks was arguing, even though he doesn't articulate it for this audience. Why was it, according to Rabbi Sacks' own thinking, as we've seen this evening, that God did not simply say, no more child sacrifice? Why? The answer is because the moral logic of the Torah, the moral logic that the Torah and the Jewish people introduced to humanity, was not the logic of philosophy that says, if something's wrong, say it's wrong and then hope for the best. No. The Torah wants us to actually change, not just say we're going to change, not just insist that we must change. The Torah wants us to actually change. And the way that people change is by being led there, is by experiencing something. You could tell Avraham, you don't own your child, or you as a Kadosh Baruch Hu could actually engage in a relationship with Avraham, take him through a story, take him through an experience, promise him a child, give him a child, lead him up Mount Moriah, lead him up Har Hamoriah, and at the last moment intervene. That was how you demonstrate to Avraham Avinu that no more child sacrifice. It was only through the logic of story. It was only the God of stories who could truly abolish child sacrifice. It wasn't the gods of Greece or Rome or the Aztecs or Carthage or anybody else, all of whom engaged in some form of child sacrifice. It wasn't the great philosophical kingdoms that abolished child sacrifice. It was only the religion of story. And so On that note, I'll end simply by relating just a quick story that I think demonstrates that Rabbi Sacks didn't merely write this and merely think this, but actually lived it. The last call that I got from Rabbi Sacks was before Rosh Hashanah. And Rabbi Sacks used to call before the Yomim Noraim just to say hello, just to wish a good Yontif. And I remember the first time that he did it, I was floored. And I remember saying to Rabbi Sacks, forgive me, I hope this isn't a rude question, but why are you calling me? And he said, and he jokingly said at the time, I won't do the accent. He said, well, I reserve the right not to call you next year. But the fact that Rabbi Sacks took the time, not merely to we had a relationship, but he could have interacted with me when I wrote him a letter asking him a question about his writing. He could have been satisfied not to interact with me at all because I was a nobody. I wasn't am a nobody, and Rabbi Sacks was a somebody, and somebodies typically don't have time for nobodies. And yet, Rabbi Sacks took the time to call a young man on Erev Chag for no other reason than he truly believed that it was important to have relationships with people. And I know that I was far from the only random person that Rabbi Sacks called on Erev Chag or Erev Yom Kippur, on Erev Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur. Rabbi Sacks truly believed in not just believing in stories, but in living stories. He believed that we don't just worship a God of relationships. We are people bound to imitate that God and create special, loving, warm, caring relationships with other people. Especially in the days ahead, as we in the West face the prospect of those relationships sometimes seeming like they're no longer possible. It sometimes seems, whether in our country or abroad, that it is impossible for people, even people of good conscience and good faith, to have conversations with each other if they disagree. And if there is one lesson we can take from Rabbi Sacks, and if there is one way for us to extend his legacy, to champion his values, and to keep his memory alive, it will be by insisting in having meaningful, warm experiences with other people and cultivating loving relationships, even with those with whom we'd rather not interact. That is the legacy of Rabbi Sacks. I thank you so much for spending time with me this evening, and I look forward to sharing more Torah with you, whether as the teacher or as an audience member, in the weeks and months to come.
Thank you so much. That was a great presentation. And, you know, the rabbi's ability to be able to convey that thinking to the average individual, his mentorship of individuals, his willingness to teach, certainly is a great aspect of his legacy. And one, Rabbi Lamb, that I hope you will continue with. So
anything.
Thank you so much for this. I'm sure your grandfather rightfully is quite proud, and may you continue the work of the two great men against whom you've spoken, for whom you've spoken over the past 2 weeks. Thank you so much for your teaching.
Laila Tov, everyone.